Welcome, Deep Divers. Today, we're plunging into, well, one of the most compelling and often, I think, misunderstood figures in American history.
Definitely complex.
We're talking about a man globally celebrated for saving millions from starvation, literally millions, a self-made millionaire engineer, yet his very name, almost cruelly, became synonymous with national despair, Hoovervilles.
Yeah, it's such a stark contrast, isn't it? It really is the paradox of Herbert Hoover.
Exactly.
You picture this orphaned kid, humble Quaker beginnings in Iowa, rising to, you know, international fame, immense wealth, just through sheer brain power and drive.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's just vilified, politically shattered, really during the biggest economic crisis the country had ever faced. Mm-hmm. His story, it just defies any easy labels.
It really does. So our mission today for you is to peel back those easy labels. We want to dive deep into the multifaceted man behind them.
Hey, get past the headline.
We'll uncover his surprising triumphs, the deeply held beliefs that really guided him, and the immense, often just overwhelming challenges he faced.
And we're drawing from a pretty comprehensive overview of his life and career here.
Right. We're pulling out those crucial nuggets, those insights that really define his legacy, hopefully giving you a fuller picture. So let's unpack this truly fascinating American story.
Let's do it. ##1. Early life and unexpected beginnings.
Okay, so to really get Hoover, you almost have to start with his childhood. It's a story of, well, remarkable hardship, but also this almost unbelievable resilience.
Yeah, it sets the stage for so much. He was born in West Branch, Iowa, that's 1874, into a devout Quaker family.
Quakers, right. His father, Jesse Hoover, was a blacksmith, also had a farm implement business. You know, modest but stable life.
And his mother, Huldah Minthorn Hoover, she was quite prominent in their church's prayer life. Known for her faith, but also apparently quite intellectually curious.
But that stability, it just didn't last.
Tragically short-lived. Herbert, or Bertie as they called him. He was only 6 when his father died suddenly. Heart attack. Just 34 years old.
Wow, 6.
Yeah. And the family struggled, obviously. Then, just 3 years later, his mother gets typhoid fever and dies too, leaving Herbert and his 2 siblings completely orphaned.
I mean, it's almost impossible to imagine the emotional weight, the practical burden, losing both parents before you're 10.
It's profound. And this brutal early experience, it really shaped him. It instilled this deep, almost instinctual self-reliance and an absolutely unwavering work ethic. You see that thread throughout his whole life.
That's such a crucial point because he ends up bouncing between relatives, lived for a bit with his uncle Alan Hoover on a farm back in Iowa, you know, learning the tough life of farming.
Right. And then, age 11, he moves clear across the country, Newburgh, Oregon, to live with another uncle, John Minthorn. He was a Quaker physician. Also a businessman.
A different kind of environment.
Very different. And apparently quite strict. Minthorn ran a tight ship, and young Herbert found himself working as an office boy. Learned bookkeeping, typing. This early exposure to both, you know, physical labor on the farm and then the sort of nascent world of business. It's incredibly formative.
You can just see how a kid facing those challenges, that kind of loss and upheaval, would develop this extraordinary capacity to just adapt and overcome.
Absolutely. It really set the stage for a young man who wasn't going to be defined by, say, academic brilliance alone.
Oh.
Which is interesting because when he gets to Stanford University in 1891.
Part of the very first class, the pioneer class.
Right, the inaugural class.
Yeah.
He famously failed all his entrance exams except mathematics.
Oh, but math. That's amazing.
Yeah. He himself later said he's a mediocre student.
Nah.
But that label, it kind of misses where his real talents were, I think.
And that's where it gets really interesting, doesn't it? Because maybe he wasn't hitting the books in the traditional sense, but his energy, it was channeled into these intensely practical things and campus leadership.
Exactly. He had all sorts of part-time jobs, like doing laundry for other students, working as a geological assistant, just showing that innate drive.
Always working.
Always working.
Yeah.
And more impressively, he co-founds the Romero Hall Boarding Club. This was the university's first student cooperative boarding house.
A co-op, okay.
Yeah, and it wasn't just about saving cash. The stated goal was sociability and economy. It was a pragmatic solution to student living costs, but it also shows that early talent for organizing, for community building.
And this is the supposedly shy kid, right?
Yeah, described as naturally shy. But his organizational skills just shone through. He becomes the student treasurer, famously manages both the baseball and the football teams, even helps organize the very first big game against Cal.
Wow, so these weren't just fun activities.
No. There were real opportunities to hone his leadership, his administrative skills, often kind of behind the scenes. And then he gets an internship with the U.S. Geological Survey. That confirms it for him. Mining geology, that's his path.
So the picture forming here isn't the bookish academic.
Not at all. It's this profoundly practical, driven, resourceful young guy with this innate knack for organizing, leading, adapting. These are the exact traits that are going to define his incredible global career just a few years later.
And those traits, yeah, they absolutely propelled him onto the global stage, and with astonishing speed, really. After graduating, it's the Panic of 1893.
Tough time to find work.
Right, a stark reminder of economic instability. But he eventually gets a job, low paying, with a prominent mining engineer, Louis Jeannin. Started literally pushing ore carts, I think.
Yeah, basic labor first, then moved up to a saying, eventually became an assistant. Real grunt work grounded him in the nuts and bolts of the industry.
But then, 1897 comes this huge opportunity.
Life-changing, really. He gets recruited by Buick, Moring & Co. This was a top-tier, London-based mining firm. And get this, he's just 23. They send him to Western Australia as their chief mining engineer.
At 23.
23, with a phenomenal salary for the time. $5,000 a year. That's like, what, nearly $190,000 today.
Incredible, and his job.
To basically revitalize these failing gold mines on the edge of the Great Victoria Desert. He arrives in this land he describes so vividly,
Yeah.
characterized by black flies, red dust, and white heat.
Sounds brutal.
Oh, incredibly harsh. Isolated conditions, really roughing it.
It does sound like something out of an adventure novel. He's not just an engineer, he's like an explorer, a problem solver in the middle of nowhere.
Absolutely. And his work in Australia, it was transformative. He brought in modern American mining methods, boosted efficiency, found new ore bodies. The company ended up controlling something like 50% of Western Australia's gold production because of his efforts.
50%, that's staggering. But you mentioned it wasn't all smooth sailing. There was controversy.
Right, and this is where it gets really interesting and reveals some early complexities in his thinking that, well, they echo later. See, to cut costs and also push back against the growing labor movement, Australian miners were organizing, pushing for better wages, safer conditions.
Naturally.
Hoover controversially brought in Italian immigrants. They'd work for less. Now, this decision, economically driven, sure, but it sparked huge opposition from the Australian unions.
Okay, I see.
And these experiences managing large-scale operations in these really tough, remote places, they kind of solidified his opposition to what he saw as restrictive labor protections. Things like minimum wage, workers' comp. He felt they unfairly burdened the owners, hindered efficiency.
So these hard knocks, real-world experiences, directly shaped his view on that tension between industry and labor, a tension that would, you know, dominate the century.
Exactly. And from Australia, his career just keeps rocketing upward. He gets promoted to junior partner, moves to China, developing gold mines near Tianjin.
China, okay. Another complex situation.
Very. And his perspective there was also complex. He was genuinely interested in Chinese history and culture, studied the language, collected artifacts. But at the same time, he publicly warned about what he called the inefficiency and perceived racial inferiority of Chinese workers.
Oof, that's difficult to hear today.
It is. Deeply problematic views, even for the time. But here's the contradiction. He held these views, yet he also tried to improve their terrible working conditions by ending these exploitative long-term servitude contracts.
So a real contradiction there. Judgmental, yet reformist in a way.
It speaks to the nuanced and, yeah, sometimes uncomfortable reality of looking back at historical figures. His time in China wasn't just complex, it was dangerous. In 1900, he and his wife, Lou Henry, they get trapped in Tianjin during the Boxer Rebellion.
Right, the Boxer Rebellion.
We're stuck with other foreigners, endure this harrowing siege, shelling, starvation. They barely survive until multinational forces rescue them. This direct experience of international conflict, chaos, it must have deepened his understanding of global politics immensely.
Absolutely, firsthand experience.
After that, he becomes an operating partner in a new Sino-British mining venture. His job requires constant travel. He's visiting mines across continents. He really is a global figure way before politics was even on the radar.
But his time with Buick, Moring, it didn't end well.
No, it ended pretty tumultuously. He left the company because of mounting legal and financial problems. There was a particularly nasty scandal involving a partner who admitted to stock fraud. But this difficult experience, it kind of propelled him into his next phase. He strikes out on his own, sets himself up as an independent mining consultant and financier based in London, his specialty. Reviving troubled mining operations, they called him the Doctor of Sick Minds.
Doctor of Sick Minds, I like that.
He and his associates, they really were engineering doctors to sick concerns.
And he built a global network doing this.
Unparalleled network and expertise. He sets up offices in all the key financial and mining hubs. San Francisco, London, New York, Paris, Petrograd, even Mandalay.
Wow.
And by 1914, through incredibly shrewd investments, brilliant engineering, he's amassed a personal fortune of $4
million. $4 million in 1914.
That's over $125 million in today's money. Just astounding wealth. He co-founded the Zinc Corporation in Australia, introduced this groundbreaking froth flotation process for getting minerals out of ore.
Froth flotation?
Yeah, revolutionary method. Vastly improved recovery, especially for complex ores. He also worked extensively in Burma, in Russia, significantly boosting mineral production there too.
Mm-hmm. So he's not just a manager, he's an innovator. But beyond the business, you mentioned he was an intellectual.
A serious one. He published his Principles of Mining in 1909. It becomes a standard textbook. And what's really surprising for the time is that the book actually reflects some progressive ideas. He endorsed things like the 8-hour workday, recognized the importance of organized labor.
Which seems like a contrast to some of his earlier actions.
It does. It highlights that complexity again. And then there's this remarkable scholarly achievement. He and his wife, Lou Henry, she was a fellow Stanford geology grad, very accomplished herself. They undertake this massive project.
What was that?
Translating Georges Agricola's 16th century De Rerum Metallica. It's the classic work on mining and metallurgy written in Latin.
Wow, translating a 16th century Latin text on mining.
Exactly. Their translation, meticulously annotated, published in 1912, it's still considered foundational. It really shows their intellectual partnership.
That's incredible. And personally?
Well, despite that Quaker upbringing, he apparently rarely attended meetings as an adult. But he and Lou built this life together, had two sons, a life that was clearly intellectually vibrant and incredibly globally ambitious.
Okay, so you'd think, right, a guy with that kind of global success, huge wealth, intellectual pursuits, he'd just settle into private life.
Seems logical.
Mm-hmm.
But then World War I happens, and it completely changes his path, redirects everything.
How did it start?
August 1914, war breaks out. There are something like 100,000 Americans stranded in Europe. Hoover's in London at the time. He uses his massive network to basically organize a committee, get them all home safely.
Seems like a practical, helpful thing to do.
Exactly. But it was the catalyst. He actually reflected on it later, saying, this is a great quote. I did not realize it at the moment, but on August 3, 1914, my career was over forever. I was on the slippery road of public life.
Wow. Slippery road. He knew it was a turning point.
A dramatic, irreversible turn. From engineering and finance to this life of just unparalleled public service humanitarian work. And he jumped in with that typical Hoover energy.
And his first huge project was just monumental, right? The Commission for Relief in Belgium, the CRB.
Monumental is the word. Germany invades Belgium, occupies it, creates this massive food crisis because under international law at the time, the occupying power wasn't obligated to feed the civilians.
Okay, so the Belgians are starving.
Exactly. But the British have a naval blockade against Germany. They won't let food in unless a strictly neutral party supervises the whole thing, makes absolutely sure the food doesn't go to the Germans.
Sounds like an impossible diplomatic knot.
Completely impossible. And Hoover steps right into the middle of it. He essentially engineers the CRB. It becomes, as someone described it, a veritable independent republic of relief.
An independent republic.
Yeah. With its own flag, its own navy, factories, mills, railroads. I mean, this organization operated on a scale and with a level of diplomatic independence you just didn't see outside of actual governments.
That's incredible. How did he manage it?
He worked from London, 14-hour days apparently, coordinating this huge fleet of ships, negotiating supply routes, dealing directly with the German occupation authorities. He crossed the North Sea, which was dangerous during the war, 40 times to negotiate.
40 times.
Administering relief for 9 million war victims. 9 million people.
Mm-hmm.
An American diplomat, Walter Page, recognized just how insane this was. He said, Hoover was probably the only man living who has privately, i.e. without holding office, negotiated understandings with the British, French, German, Dutch, and Belgian governments.
Privately negotiated.
Yeah. It just shows this unbelievable skill in diplomacy, logistics, and building trust between warring sides, all for humanitarian aims. It's like a masterclass in global problem solving.
Just stunning. A stunning display of genius, really. So when the U.S. finally enters the war in 1917...
President Wilson knows exactly who to call. He sees Hoover's unique abilities and appoints him to lead the U.S. Food Administration.
The Food Czar.
He quickly earns that nickname, yeah. recruits hundreds of thousands of volunteers across the country. His main goal was twofold: get essential food to the Allies to keep them fighting, and stabilize food prices at home to prevent economic problems. And crucially, he wanted to do it without resorting to mandatory rationing, which was politically really difficult.
So how did he do it without rationing?
He launched the Hooverizing campaign.
Yeah.
Voluntary conservation. It was incredibly successful. Not just a slogan, it mobilized the whole country.
Right. Meatless Mondays.
Meatless Mondays, wheatless Wednesdays, and when in doubt, eat potatoes. Families across America bought in. These small collective actions had a massive impact. They shipped 23 million metric tons of food to the Allies.
23 million tons.
It was absolutely crucial in preventing the Allies from collapsing and ultimately helped win the war. And this effort earned Hoover huge national acclaim, especially among progressives who just admired his expert administration, his efficiency.
So the war ends November 1918, armistice. But the crisis isn't over.
Far from it. Europe is devastated, widespread starvation looming. Estimates were maybe 400 million people at risk.
400 million.
Yeah. So Hoover just seamlessly transitions the Food Administration into the American Relief Administration, the ARA. Another massive undertaking, providing aid across Central and Eastern Europe, even rebuilding critical infrastructure, railways, bridges.
He's everywhere.
And he becomes a close advisor to Wilson at the Paris Peace Conference. He's passionately advocating for the League of Nations, for what he called a good peace, one based on reconciliation, not just punishment. Even John Maynard Keynes, who was famously critical of the Versailles Treaty.
Right, Keynes ripped it apart.
Exactly. But Keynes singled out Hoover for praise. He noted Hoover's realism, knowledge, magnanimity, and disinterestedness. High praise from a tough critic.
And this humanitarian drive, it went beyond just the Allies, right?
Absolutely. And this is crucial for understanding his character, I think. Despite a lot of political opposition back home, Hoover extends aid to defeated Germany.
Yeah.
And perhaps even more controversially, to famine-stricken Soviet Russia. Millions were dying there.
Aid to the Bolsheviks. That must have been unpopular.
Hugely unpopular. But Hoover famously declared, 20 million people are starving. Whatever their politics, they shall be fed. That act, driven by those deep Quaker values of universal compassion, it really makes you think, doesn't it?
It does. How do you balance humanitarian needs against politics, especially in crisis? Where does empathy stop?
It's a timeless question. And around the same time, 1919, he also sets up the Hoover War Collection at Stanford. Now it's the Hoover Institution Library and Archives.
Yeah.
He meticulously saved documents about the war, the revolutions, mm-hmm. recognizing how important preserving that history was.
So all this work, this global stage,
yeah.
it naturally makes him a potential presidential candidate in 1920.
Completely propelled him into the national spotlight. And he appealed to progressives. He was advocating for some pretty forward-thinking stuff. Higher taxes on wealth, a minimum wage, a 48-hour work week, ending child labor.
Sounds almost like a Democrat today.
Well, initially, he didn't even declare a party. He kind of hoped maybe both parties would want him. Eventually, he declared as a Republican.
But it didn't work out.
No. His progressive leanings, plus his close ties to the outgoing Democrat, Wilson, that alienated conservative farmers and the powerful Republican old guard. The political climate was just too polarized for someone who'd operated mostly above the partisan fray on this global humanitarian level. His candidacy basically fizzled after they lost the California primary.
So his unique mix wasn't quite right for the party politics of the moment.
Seems that way. Expert administration and progressive ideals? Maybe not what the established parties were looking for right then.
Okay, so the 1920 presidential run doesn't pan out. But his reputation, still sky high, humanitarian, brilliant organizer, undeniable.
Absolutely. So President Warren G. Harding wins the election, recognizes Hoover's talents, offers him a cabinet post. And Hoover makes a really interesting choice.
What does he pick?
The Commerce Department, which back then was considered kind of a minor post. Small budget, vaguely defined duties, mostly just collecting statistics.
Not exactly glamorous.
Not at all. But this is Herbert Hoover, right? He had a radically different vision. He didn't see it as minor. He saw it as the hub of the nation's growth and stability.
A hub. Okay. Ambitious.
And he didn't just sit there. He dramatically expanded its power, its influence. He famously just seized responsibilities from other departments if he thought they were dropping the ball or if a new national need popped up.
He just took them.
Pretty much. This proactive, almost audacious approach quickly earned him that nickname. Secretary of Commerce and Undersecretary of all other departments.
Huh. That says it all.
It really does. What's fascinating is how he just redefined the role, showed that characteristic drive, that belief in expert administration, efficiency, progress. He wanted to promote efficiency, cut waste, boost production, conserve resources. He talked about a third alternative, a path between, you know, unrestrained capitalism and socialism, government as a facilitator, a data gatherer, promoting voluntary cooperation.
And he dives into new technologies with that same energy.
Boundless zeal. Take radio. Just think, between 1923 and 1929, the number of families with radios exploded from like 300,000 to over 10 million. It was chaos on the airwaves.
The Wild West of radio.
Totally. Hoover steps in. He organizes these national conferences, broadcasters, manufacturers, regulators, all in one room. They lay the groundwork for the Radio Act of 1927. This allowed the federal government to step in and regulate stations that were considered non-useful or just causing interference. It was groundbreaking stuff, regulating a brand new mass medium.
And aviation, too. Air travel was just starting.
Equally profound impact there. He saw the potential, but also the risks. He didn't want it to develop chaotically, so he actively encouraged private industry, but at the same time pushed hard for safety regulations.
What kind of regulations?
Under him, the Commerce Department developed emergency landing fields across the country. They mandated lights and radio beams on runways, established federal power to inspect planes, licensed pilots. These were crucial steps, setting the precedent for federal oversight that eventually led to the FAA. He saw the future and moved to make it safer, more efficient.
That practical organizing mind again, even for everyday things.
Absolutely. The automobile was changing everything, bringing mobility, but also new dangers in cities. So he hosts these national conferences on street and highway safety, experts, city leaders. Mm-hmm. They come up with a uniform vehicle code and the model municipal traffic ordinance.
Standardizing traffic laws.
Yeah, promoting uniformity across states. Mm-hmm. And significantly, helping prioritize the car in city planning. It shows that foresight, again, anticipating the impact of new tech and trying to bring order to rapid change.
Now, despite all the success, you mentioned he had this Britain problem because he'd worked for British firms.
Right. Biographers point this out. There was this political risk, especially in that nationalistic era, that he could be painted as too pro-British, maybe even a British tool.
So how did he handle that politically?
Strategically. First, he cultivated that image of the dispassionate scientist, then the humanitarian during the war relief. And finally, he used a tactic he called twisting the British tail.
Twisting the British tail? What does that mean?
We saw it clearly during the rubber crisis of 1925-26. Britain controlled like 75% of the world's rubber. They set up this scheme to restrict exports, and prices tripled. It hammered American industries, especially cars.
Okay.
Hoover went on the attack. Vociferously denounced it as a monopolistic practice. He basically turned British economic policy into a nationalist issue for Americans. It shows how even really capable public servants have to play the image game, manage political vulnerabilities to stay viable.
Fascinating political maneuvering. And speaking of navigating challenges, the Great Mississippi Flood of 1927, huge disaster.
Immense devastation. Banks, levees break across seven states. 1.5 million people displaced. And even though disaster response wasn't technically Commerce's job.
The governors asked for Hoover specifically?
They did. They asked President Coolidge to put Hoover in charge of the federal response. Coolidge was reluctant at first, you know, states' rights, local responsibility, but the political pressure was intense.
So Hoover takes charge.
And with that characteristic energy, sets up over 100 tent cities, deploys a fleet of over 600 boats for rescue and supply. Personally raises $17 million for relief. This rapid, effective leadership just boosted his national profile even more. By 1928, you could argue he was almost overshadowing Coolidge, the indispensable problem solver.
But there was a darker side to that flood response.
There was. A deeply troubling, often overlooked part. Hoover apparently ordered the suppression of reports about the widespread mistreatment of African Americans in the refugee camps. They faced forced labor, segregation, terrible conditions.
He suppressed the reports. Why?
Seems it was done with the cooperation of a prominent black leader, Robert Russell Moton. The understanding, apparently, was that Moton would get influence and consideration once Hoover became president. That's a really stark example of how even humanitarian efforts can get tangled up with political calculations and expose those deep racial injustices of the time.
That's very disturbing. Beyond these huge events, what else was he doing at Commerce?
He turned the department into this powerhouse of economic information, recruited top academics to publish reports, giving businesses and policymakers vital data. He pushed hard for industrial standardization, getting industries to agree on uniform sizes for everything from car tires to Believe it or not, baby bottle nipples.
Baby bottle nipples, seriously.
Seriously. All about eliminating waste, boosting efficiency. He also strongly supported the Own Your Own Home campaign, worked with bankers to promote long-term mortgages, which really helped fuel housing construction in the middle class. Secured U.S. Steel's agreement to an 8-hour workday, played a key role in the Colorado River Compact, sorting out water rights in the West.
He was incredibly active.
Tireless. And all this success, this high visibility, plus the booming, roaring 20s economy, it made him the obvious choice for the 1928 Republican presidential nomination. Secured it on the first ballot.
In the election.
Landslide victory over the Democrat, Al Smith. Won 58% of the popular vote, 444 electoral votes. People credited his reputation as the efficient expert, the prosperity, and also deep splits in the Democratic Party over things like religion. Smith was Catholic and prohibition.
Now, there was an interesting detail about the census.
Yeah, it's often overlooked. The 1920 census results were never actually used to reapportion Congress. So the Electoral College in 28 was based on outdated population figures from 1910. Could it have changed the outcome? Hard to say definitively, but it's a factor.
And his strategy in the South, the Lily White strategy?
That was hugely significant and damaging in the long run. He deliberately removed Black Republicans from leadership positions in the South, trying to appeal to white Southern voters. It deeply alienated African American leaders.
And this contributed to the shift.
Many historians see it as a key reason why Black voters who had traditionally supported the Republican Party, the party of Lincoln, started moving towards the Democratic Party in the following decades. A major political realignment was beginning.
So Herbert Hoover walks into the White House, March 1929, immense goodwill, this amazing reputation, great engineer, great humanitarian, and just boundless optimism.
Oh, the optimism was palpable. He famously declared, "Given the chance to go forward with the policies of the last 8 years, we shall soon, with the help of God, be in sight of the day when poverty will be banished from this nation."
Banished from the nation. Wow.
And people believed it. It reflected that buoyant spirit of the roaring 20s. Mm-hmm. But beneath that shiny surface, some really dangerous economic problems were festering, largely ignored, or at least downplayed.
Like what? What were the warning signs?
Well, you had the ongoing farm crisis. Agricultural prices had tanked after WWI and never really recovered. Consumer goods, especially cars, appliances, they were hitting market saturation. Demand was slowing down. Crucially, income inequality was massive and growing. Wealth was concentrated at the top, which limited purchasing power for most people.
And the stock market.
Yeah, the big one. Excessive speculation had driven stock prices way, way beyond their actual value. A classic bubble. Some regulators, some cautious bankers, they actually warned Coolidge, and then President-elect Hoover urged them to curb speculation.
But they didn't act.
Both were reluctant. Limited government intervention was their philosophy. They didn't want to interfere directly with the Federal Reserve System's operations.
And then?
Then, just months into his term, October 1929, the stock market crashes. Black Tuesday. It signals the brutal start of the Great Depression.
And this just completely redefined his presidency.
Completely. Transformed his image from savior to, well, perceived failure. His view of the problem was key. He didn't see it as a fundamental flaw in capitalism. He saw it primarily as a lack of confidence in the financial system.
A confidence problem.
Yeah. His philosophy, rooted in that Quaker background, his self-made story, it favored bolstering businesses, banks. He thought that was the way to restore stability.
Yeah.
He strongly opposed direct federal relief to individuals. He feared creating a dole, something that would weaken self-reliance, initiative, the nation's moral fiber. He truly believed local governments, private charities should handle individual needs.
So his initial response reflected that philosophy.
Exactly. Voluntarism, indirect action. Right after the crash, he calls in top business and labor leaders, urges them. Don't cut wages. Don't have strikes. Keep things going voluntarily. He convinced railroads, utilities to spend more on infrastructure, hoping for private stimulus, urged the Fed to cut interest rates, secured more money for the Federal Farm Board to help agriculture.
All aimed at stimulus preventing deflation.
Right. But all while sticking to his guns. No direct federal relief for the unemployed. State and local responsibility. That was his mantra.
But then came a major misstep. The Smoot-Hawley tariff.
Huge, controversial misstep. June 1930. Hoover initially just wanted higher tariffs on agricultural goods to help farmers. But it got tangled up in Congress. The final bill jacked up tariffs on hundreds of imported goods across the board.
Did he support that broader bill?
He wasn't directly involved in the congressional wrangling, but over 1,000 economists warned against it. Still, he felt he had to sign it. It was the main legislative achievement of the Republican Congress, and he feared a political backlash if he vetoed it.
And the consequence?
Severe. Immediate. Canada, France, dozens of other countries retaliated instantly with their own tariffs on American goods. It sparked this vicious global trade war. International trade just collapsed. It made the economic crisis catastrophically worse everywhere.
So it backfired badly.
Horribly. Historians often cite it as a major factor that deepened the Depression. It wrecked his political standing, worsened the economy, isolated the U.S. It was a critical turning point, really.
And the situation kept getting worse.
Yeah. End of 1930, unemployment hits 11.9%. Worrying. But people still didn't grasp how deep this was going to be. Then, 1931, a wave of catastrophic bank failures wiped out savings, paralyzed credit, just escalated the collapse dramatically.
And Hoover's position on the gold standard?
He refused to abandon it. Tied the dollar's value to gold. He saw any alternative as irresponsible, called it collectivism, thought leaving gold would cause runaway inflation, destroy financial stability completely.
He also blamed Europe partly, right?
Deeply convinced the weak European economy, tangled in war debts, was dragging America down. Germany was near collapse in 31, so he initiated the Hoover moratorium, a one-year halt on all European war debt and reparations payments. Hoped it would give them breathing room.
Did it work?
Well-intentioned, but ultimately no. It didn't stop further defaults, didn't stop the cascading financial crisis in Europe, and tragically, that deepened economic distress, especially in Germany. It directly fueled the rise of extremist movements. Figures like Hitler capitalized on that despair.
So by mid-1931, things are really bad. Unemployment soaring.
15% by mid-31. Painfully clear, this was way worse than any previous downturn. And Hoover himself, he was naturally reserved, hated public speaking, political showmanship. He struggled badly with his public image.
And his opponents seized on that.
Oh, effectively and often cruelly. Democrats painted him as cold, incompetent, reactionary, just out of touch. Those awful terms sprung up. Hoovervilles for the shanty towns, Hoover leather for cardboard shoes, Hoover blanket for newspapers.
Yeah.
They became these pervasive symbols of his perceived failure.
It really makes you wonder, doesn't it? How much did his personality, his communication style, maybe his aversion to public performance, how much did that affect his ability to lead, even with his experience and intentions?
It's a huge question. It highlights just how crucial, effective public communication, showing empathy, really is during a national crisis, regardless of underlying competence.
Okay, so early 1932, unemployment is nearing, what, 23%? Just catastrophic numbers. The pressure on Hoover is immense.
Unbearable. Faced with just undeniable suffering across the nation, the total failure of his voluntary approach, he finally agrees to more direct federal action. This was a huge shift for him, given his core beliefs.
What was the big move?
The Reconstruction Finance Corporation.
Yeah.
The RFC, established January 1932. This was a powerful new federal agency designed to give government-backed loans to struggling banks, railroads, local governments.
So the government's stepping in to prop up institutions.
Exactly. An unprecedented expansion of federal power in peacetime. Now, it did save a lot of banks and businesses from failing completely, prevented an even deeper collapse. But it didn't really stimulate lending or kickstart the economy like Hoover hoped.
Why not?
Partly because it was run by pretty conservative bankers.
Mm.
They were maybe understandably hesitant to make risky loans in that climate. And it was definitely trickle-down aid, help the big institutions, hope it eventually reaches individuals, rather than direct relief.
What else did he do around then?
He signed the Federal Home Loan Bank Act, created a system like the Fed, but for housing, to try and stabilize that market. Helped pass the Glass-Steagall Act of 1932, that was emergency banking law to expand credit, stop gold hoarding. And then July 32, another concession, the Emergency Relief and Construction Act, a $2 billion public works bill to create jobs.
These all sound like pretty major federal actions for a fiscal conservative.
Extraordinary moves for him, completely against his instincts in many ways.
But the budget was still a massive problem.
Huge problem. After a decade of surpluses, the government had a crippling deficit in 31. Hoover, deeply believing in balanced budgets for stability and confidence, proposed a drastic 30% tax increase.
Increased taxes during a depression.
Yeah. Led directly to the Revenue Act of 1932. Increased taxes across the board, individual income, corporate taxes. The top income tax rate soared to 63%, highest since the early 1920s.
Did it balance the budget?
Nope. Despite those huge tax hikes, the government still ran a significant deficit. It just shows the overwhelming scale of the Depression. Even massive tax increases couldn't keep up with the collapsing economy, the unemployment, the urgent need for spending. He was trapped. raise taxes and depress the economy more, or run deficits which he thought would destroy national credit.
Let's shift gears a bit. Civil rights and this Mexican repatriation policy, that sounds concerning.
It's a really difficult and complex part of his presidency. Hoover rarely spoke publicly about civil rights. He believed minorities should progress through education, hard work, individual effort, not federal intervention. Now, his supporters point out, he did appoint more African Americans to federal jobs than Harding or Coolidge combined.
Okay.
But he faced huge condemnation from civil rights leaders for refusing to back a federal anti-lynching law. Many saw that as a basic matter of justice.
And the Lily White strategy continued.
Yes. That calculated political move in the South, removing black Republicans to court white voters. It continued, deeply alienating African American leaders and, as we said, pushed them towards the Democrats. His nomination of Judge John J. Parker to the Supreme Court, a conservative Southerner with an anti-labor, anti-black record, just fueled that fire. The NAACP and organized labor joined forces to defeat that nomination in the Senate.
And the Mexican repatriation, what exactly was that?
It's truly disturbing. In a desperate, misguided attempt to reduce unemployment, Hoover wanted to slash immigration. An executive order in 1930 required migrants to have proof of employment before coming. Then his administration actively supported and organized these coercive campaigns to prosecute and deport illegal immigrants, mainly targeting Mexican Americans in California and the Southwest.
Coercive campaigns targeting Mexican Americans.
Yes. Between 300,000 and maybe even 2 million Mexicans and Mexican Americans were repatriated, deported, or basically expelled during the 1930s. The vast majority during Hoover's term. And here's the shocking part. Estimates are 40 to 60% of them were U.S. citizens by birth.
American citizens were deported?
Yes. It's an incredibly dark chapter. Some scholars argue it meets modern definitions of ethnic cleansing because it targeted a specific group, often regardless of citizenship. It's a tough aspect of his legacy to confront.
Absolutely. On a slightly different note, what about Native Americans?
There, he did take some positive steps. He reorganized the Bureau of Indian Affairs to try and limit the exploitation of Native Americans, improve their condition somewhat.
Okay. What about prohibition? Still the law of the land.
Very much so. Hoover took office, urging everyone to obey the 18th Amendment and the Volstead Act. He set up the Wickersham Commission to study how effective prohibition was, probably hoping they'd give it a thumbs up.
But they didn't.
No, the report was damning. Criticized the failed enforcement, noted the massive public opposition, the rise of organized crime. But Hoover, worried about losing support from prohibition advocates, refused to endorse any changes.
He stuck with it, even though public opinion was clearly shifting.
He did, but the tide had turned. People saw it as a failure. It bred crime, disrespect for the law. By January 33, Congress approved the repeal amendment. It was ratified as the 21st Amendment by December 33. The Noel experiment was over. His administration just had to ride out that powerful wave of public sentiment.
And foreign relations. The world was getting increasingly tense.
Yeah, historian William Lichtenberg said Hoover was the last American president to take office with no conspicuous need to pay attention to the rest of the world. Ironically, he presided over the unraveling of the post-WWI order.
How so? In Latin America?
He actually moved towards non-interventionism there, which was a positive shift. Released the Clark Memorandum in 1930, rejecting the old Roosevelt corollary that justified U.S. intervention. He ended the occupation of Nicaragua, nearly ended the one in Haiti.
And disarmament, was that a priority?
A big priority. He genuinely wanted to cut military spending, foster peace. He got the 1930 London Naval Treaty signed, which capped certain types of warships, a real achievement. But his bigger proposals of the 1932 World Disarmament Conference, like outlawing tanks, bombers, chemical warfare, they went nowhere. Tensions were just too high globally.
What about Japan's invasion of Manchuria in 31? That was a major crisis.
Huge crisis. Japan sets up a puppet state, violates treaties. The Hoover administration deplored it, but they were cautious. Didn't want to antagonize Japan too much. They feared weakening moderate elements in Japan and maybe alienating a potential counterweight to the Soviet Union, which Hoover saw as the bigger ideological threat.
So what did they do?
Their main response was the Stimson Doctrine, named after a Secretary of State. It basically said the U.S. wouldn't recognize any territory taken by force. A moral statement, but it had no real military or economic bite.
All these immense pressures, domestic crisis, global instability,
yeah.
And then came the Bonus Army.
Yeah, the Bonus Army incident.
Yeah.
June 1932, probably the single most damaging event for his image. Thousands of WWI veterans, desperate, broke, march on Washington.
Demanding their war bonuses early.
Exactly. Bonuses not due until 1945. They set up these camps, these Hoovervilles, right near the Capitol. After offers of money to leave didn't work for everyone, local police tried to evict the remaining veterans. It turned violent. Two protesters were killed.
And Hoover called in the army.
He made that fateful decision. Sent in U.S. Army troops under General Douglas MacArthur.
And MacArthur, well, he went way beyond his orders. Believing he was fighting some kind of communist revolution, he aggressively cleared the camps. Used cavalry, tanks, tear gas, burned the shantytowns down.
Tanks against veterans.
Looked horrific. Now, Hoover hadn't specifically ordered that level of force, but crucially, he endorsed MacArthur's actions afterward. It just cemented that public image. Cold, unsympathetic, willing to use the military on his own citizens. A PR nightmare.
So heading into the 1932 election, things looked bleak.
Bleak is an understatement. Crisis raging, bonus Arnie fresh in everyone's minds. Nobody really expected him to win. He didn't even face serious opposition for the Republican nomination, which tells you something.
And FDR.
Franklin D. Roosevelt campaigned on bold government action, a new deal. He attacked Hoover, relentlessly blamed him for the Depression, painted him as indifferent to suffering. Hoover, he broke tradition, actually went out and gave 9 major radio addresses defending his administration, his philosophy.
How did that go poorly? His delivery was described as monotone, awkward. Serious demeanor, just couldn't compete with Roosevelt's charismatic fireside chats.
And the crowds he faced.
Historians say, perhaps the most hostile crowds ever seen by a sitting president. His motorcade got pelted with eggs, rotten fruit. There were even assassination threats. His attempts to defend his record just didn't land. The hardship was too overwhelming.
And the result?
Crushing defeat, lost decisively. Carried only 6 states. His popular vote dropped by almost 19 percentage points from his 28 landslide. Just a humiliating end, cementing that image of the president who couldn't solve the Depression.
So after that devastating loss, Hoover leaves Washington. A bitter man, you said.
Understandably bitter. And he begins this incredibly long post-presidency.
Yeah.
31 years. From 1933 until 1953, he was the only living former president, a record only broken by Jimmy Carter much later. Imagine carrying that weight through decades of huge change.
And he became a major critic of FDR.
Oh, a constant vocal critic. He grew increasingly conservative, became the foil to FDR in the New Deal, wrote several books laying out his arguments. The Challenge to Liberty in 1934 is probably the most famous.
What did he say?
He attacked Roosevelt's policies fiercely, called the NRA, the National Recovery Administration, fascistic, called the 1933 Banking Act gigantic socialism. He genuinely believed the New Deal was undermining core American values, individualism, self-reliance, limited government. Feared it was leading towards totalitarianism.
Did he try to run again?
He did. Despite being deeply unpopular, he actually hoped for another shot, sought the Republican nomination in 36 and 40, but the party passed him over both times. Interestingly, he was the last president to actually seek public office after leaving the White House until Donald Trump did in 2022.
Wow. Now, during the lead up to World War II, his views were controversial.
Very much so. He remains staunchly isolationist. In 1938, he actually traveled to Europe and met with Adolf Hitler.
He met Hitler.
Yeah. He apparently expressed dismay about the persecution of Jews, but he came away believing Hitler wasn't a direct threat to the U.S. He saw FDR's foreign policy as provocative, thought it was stopping Europe from reaching some kind of accommodation with Germany, which he felt was smarter.
So he opposed U.S. involvement in the war.
Vigorously. Opposed Lend-Lease, became a prominent member of the Isolationist America First Committee. Now his humanitarian side still flickered. He rejected FDR's offers for official wartime relief roles, but he did help set up the Commission for Polish Relief, aided Belgian civilians again in 1940.
But he was against allying with the Soviets.
Strongly against it. After the Nazis invaded the USSR, he publicly disparaged any tacit alliance with Stalin. He said, "War alongside Stalin to impose freedom is more than a travesty, it is a tragedy." His unpopularity meant FDR didn't call on him for any wartime service, which apparently frustrated him personally, given his relief experience. And in 45, not knowing about the atomic bomb, he advised Truman against demanding unconditional surrender from Japan, worried about Allied casualties in an invasion. Still focused on saving lives, even in war.
It's amazing how those political views and his humanitarian side seem to coexist, sometimes uneasily. But after the war, his image started to change.
Slowly, unexpectedly, yeah. A rehabilitation began. And surprisingly, he struck up a friendship with President Harry S. Truman. Despite huge ideological differences, Truman actually valued Hoover's expertise, rose above the partisan history.
Truman used Hoover's expertise.
In 46, Truman sent Hoover to Germany and Italy, assess the post-war food situation. Hoover's reports were sharp, critical of U.S. occupation policy. But his work directly led to launching a school meals program that fed 3.5 million kids in the American and British zones. Still the humanitarian.
And the Hoover Commission.
Right, 1947. Truman appoints him to lead the Commission on Organization of INSCAP Executive Branch, tasked with finding ways to eliminate waste, streamline government, strengthen White House control. Here's the irony. The guy who slammed FDR for concentrating power now believed a stronger presidency was needed for the atomic age.
That is ironic. How was his relationship with later presidents?
He supported Dewey against Truman in 48, but they stayed friendly. He apparently disliked Eisenhower, thought Ike didn't do enough to roll back the New Deal, but Ike still appointed him to another commission. His public standing really did improve in these later years. Partly his service, partly his self-deprecating humor, that famous line.
Or one about the Depression.
Yeah. I am the only person of distinction who's ever had a depression named after him. I kind of broke the ice, let people see him differently.
Did he take the presidential pension when it was offered?
He did. Congress passed the Former President's Act in 58, offered $25,000 a year. Hoover was wealthy, didn't need it. But he apparently accepted it so as not to embarrass Truman, who supposedly did need the money and whose situation helped get the law passed.
Interesting. And his relationship with JFK?
He declined offers for roles from Kennedy. But surprisingly, he defended the Kennedy administration after the Bay of Pigs disaster and during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he was reportedly genuinely distraught by Kennedy's assassination. This whole post-presidency shows him finding his way back into public life, not through politics, but through service, writing, and this gradual public acceptance.
He kept writing, too.
Prolifically. Wrote that biography, The Ordeal of Woodrow Wilson, which maybe reflected his own understanding of facing huge global challenges as president. His magnum opus, though, was Freedom Betrayed, published after his death. A massive critique of FDR's foreign policy, especially allying with the Soviets, reflected his lifelong anti-communism.
And his very last written words were to Truman.
Yeah, just 6 days before he died. Truman had slipped in the bathtub. Hoover wrote him of this charmingly characteristic note. Bathtubs are a menace to ex-presidents, for, as you may recall, a bathtub rose up and fractured my vertebrae when I was in Venezuela on your world famine mission in 1946. My warmest sympathy and best wishes for your recovery.
That's quite a closing line.
It is. Poignant, a little humorous. He lived to be 90. Died in New York City, October 20, 1964. Received a state funeral, buried back in West Branch, Iowa, next to Lou Henry. Held that record for the longest retirement until Carter. A life that spanned just immense change, profound personal transformation.
So after tracing this incredible, complex life, what is Herbert Hoover's legacy? He left office incredibly unpopular, reviled even.
Extremely unpopular. His reputation really didn't start to recover until the 1970s, maybe even later. Historians today generally give him credit for his, quote, genuine belief in voluntarism and cooperation, and for the innovation of some of his programs, especially those later, unprecedented federal interventions during the Depression.
But the criticisms remain.
Oh, definitely. Mm. They note his perceived political ineptitude, his stiffness, and crucially, his failure to really grasp the severity, the unprecedented nature of the Depression in those critical early stages.
There's that quote from Nicholas Lemmon.
Right. Lemmon captures that common perception well. Hoover remembered as the man who was too rigidly conservative, the hapless foil to the great Franklin Roosevelt, the politician who managed to turn a Republican country into a Democratic one. Polls of historians consistently rank him in the bottom third of presidents, 36th in that 2017 C-SPAN poll, for instance.
It's fascinating how his presidency, specifically the Depression, just overshadows everything else.
It really does. That period of immense struggle became so intertwined with the historical narrative that it tragically eclipsed decades of extraordinary humanitarian work, incredible administrative achievements. That's the paradox we started with.
Yet despite all the criticism of his presidency, there's still widespread praise for his humanitarian work.
Consistent, widespread praise for that. And for his dedication to public service, both before and after the White House. Richard Pipes, the historian, put it starkly. Herbert Hoover has the rare distinction of having saved millions. For many, that remains the core of his character, even if the presidential years cloud it.
Now, the legacy and race is complicated.
Very complicated, very difficult. Racist remarks were common then, sadly. Contemporaries noted Hoover reportedly never indulged in them while president. But privately, his views reflected the prejudices of the era. He considered white people inherently superior, viewed mixture of bloods disadvantageous.
That's hard to reconcile.
It is. Yet despite these deeply problematic personal beliefs, he did support education and work for Black progress, like his support for Tuskegee Institute. And his wife, Lou Henry Hoover, made that brave move, inviting Jessie DePriest, wife of the first Black congressman in decades, to a White House tea. Broke the color bar. A symbolic act, but significant.
But leaders like W.E.B. Du Bois were critical.
Very critical. Du Bois called him an undemocratic racist, and that lily-white strategy in the South. Many historians see it as a pivotal reason for Black voters leaving the Republican Party. His early experiences in China also seem to shape his views on Asians, wrongly believing they lacked mechanical instincts. Some think this influenced his restrictive immigration policies. It just reminds you, historical figures are rarely simple heroes or villains. They're products of their time with both admirable qualities and deeply flawed views.
His name is still attached to a lot of places, though. His legacy is physically present.
Oh, absolutely. Etched into the landscape. The Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, Iowa, the Hoover Minthorn House in Oregon, where he grew up, his Rapidan Fishing Camp in Virginia, now a historic landmark, the Lou Henry and Herbert Hoover House at Stanford, now the university president's home, and of course the Hoover Institution at Stanford, that major think tank.
And the big one, Hoover Dam.
Hoover Dam, iconic feat of engineering, numerous schools, even two minor planets, 932 Hooveria and 3063 Herberta. There's a square name for him in Warsaw, Poland, for his relief work there. And that quirky medicine ball game, Hoover Ball, his doctor invented to keep him fit.
Hoover Ball.
Hoover Ball. And reflecting that early career, he's in the National Mining Hall of Fame, along with Lou Henry, and the Australian Prospectors and Miners Hall of Fame, too. His impact on global mining was lasting.
So wrapping this up, this deep dive really shows Hoover as this man of just immense talent, relentless drive, deep humanitarian conviction. His early career,
yeah,
unprecedented success, engineer, relief organizer, literally saving millions.
It was astonishing pre-presidency.
But then the presidency itself, tragically hitting right at the start of the Great Depression, cements this totally different image. Perceived inaction, political misjudgment. We've seen how his core beliefs, individualism, limited government, even shaped by some early progressive ideas, just clashed violently with the demands of this unimaginable economic crisis.
It's a powerful, profoundly complex story. Hoover's life, especially everything before and after the presidency, stands in such stark contrast to that presidential legacy. It really raises a provocative question for you, the listener.
What's that?
Can a lifetime of extraordinary service, a person's fundamental character, be truly eclipsed, totally redefined by one period of immense challenge and how the public perceived it, especially when they're caught in a storm, maybe bigger than any one leader could fully control? And what does that tell us about how history remembers its leaders? About our own ability to see the nuances.
That is a truly thought-provoking question to leave you with. We definitely encourage you to explore further, maybe visit one of those memorials, dig into the Hoover Institution archives, form your own nuanced understanding of this complex, pivotal figure in American history. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.